You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud. So the first time I ever saw my guest was in the late 90s. It was in a dirty little bar on the Lower East Side in New York City. It was at a spoken word event or maybe a slam poetry night, and it was crowded. When she got on stage, people got quiet. I mean, even drunk people got quiet. Words burst out of her mouth, and we all stood there entranced. The writing was brilliant, but it was her voice and presence that made you take notice. And she wasn't selling flowery love poems. She was spewing sex and rage and wonder and revolution. She made people uncomfortable, but they couldn't look away. That woman is Stacey Ann Chin. And even though I told you that about her, I'm still going to read her bio because we've earned our bios. And I don't believe in modesty. Poet, actor, and performing artist Stacey Ann Chin is the author of the poetry collection Crossfire, A Litany for Survival, the critically acclaimed memoir, The Other Side of Paradise, co-writer and original performer in the Tony Award-winning Russell Simmons Deaf Poetry Jam on Broadway, and author of the one-woman shows Hands of Fire, Unspeakable Things, Border Clash, and Motherstruck. She has appeared on The Oprah Winfrey Show and 60 Minutes, and her poetry has been featured in The New York Times and The Washington Post. She proudly identifies as Caribbean, Black, Asian, lesbian, a woman, a resident of New York City, as well as a Jamaican national. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Stacey Ann.
Oh, that was like, you know, that's a hard act to follow. I mean, now I have to be good.
I didn't mean to set you up, but really, I did see you more than 20 years ago. It was the first time I heard you read your
work. Was that in Bar 13 or was it in Bowery, the Bowery poetry?
The Bowery. You're right. It's the Bowery. Yeah.
It was like right beside CBGB's, right?
Yes.
I know. And now both those things are gone.
Are gone. I mean, yeah, that was a different New York. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. The Bowery Poetry Club. Is it still there or not there?
I don't know because I've left New York and I'm in LA now and I don't know.
Are you in LA? Oh my God. I'm sorry to hear that.
It's it's okay. It's okay. We're making it work over here.
I have so many friends who live in LA. Gloria Bigelow, Gina Yashere. I mean, like, you know, LA is just so not... They all say, oh my God, it's great. It's great. The sunshine, and you can find the community you want. It just feels so much more plastic than I have experienced New York to be. Mm. But I'm probably being snobbish. There's probably like a whole bunch of like queer, radical, like, you know.
There are.
Progressive, inclusive, wonderful humans in LA. It's just that, you know, I just think that like the seven friends that I have out there are the only ones who are like that, and everybody else is doing boob jobs and pouting in all of their interviews.
Yeah, you have to come to the East Side. That's all happening in like Beverly Hills, but there's some amazing community here, absolutely. Now, granted, a lot of them are transplants from other places.
Right.
But even the native Los Angelians are, it's a great community, actually.
You know, I never knew that before. Do they say Los Angelians?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I've only been here like 5 years. So like, I don't even consider, I still consider myself like from New York. I can't say I'm from LA. I say I live in LA.
I'm such a Brooklynite. In my head, they've always been LAites.
Oh, LAites. No, yeah, no one says that here.
They're for Brooklynites.
Right, right.
Anyways.
Okay. You know.
People who are listening might not share our fascination with language and how it evolves and how things become things and things become not things.
Yes. So I've been reading your book. I think that most people can agree on this thing about you, which is that you never let up. By that, I mean, like, you're really driven and you're a force to be reckoned with. And I'm wondering how you're feeling right now in this moment. It's a moment of uprising, of reckoning in this country. I'm not trying to be like deliberately vague, but.
No, I get it. I mean,
how are you?
I know that question is a vague question. The answers are always vague in this moment. I think that 2016 ushered in a particular moment in our history, particularly our activist history. The work we do, I mean, I imagine the work you do to tell stories that are going to present a different idea of America or, you know, feminist or queer people or immigrants or whatever. I think that this work has been going on from as long as I have known myself in America. I happened upon the US into that space you just mentioned, you saw me performing. I landed in America looking for a space that would allow me to be out, open, queer, and celebrated. And I was coming from a place where my experiences in Jamaica had made it such that I was terrified of being in Jamaica and terrified of being the way that I am. And when I say the way that I am, I mean as loudly lesbian as I was in the late 90s, mid to late 90s. And so I came into the US hoping to find some kind of, you know, flower power, you know, feminist, girl-loving, vagina-wielding, you know, I don't know, patchouli wearing, natural hair, sandalwood smelling sort of existence. And I was surprised, you know, and disappointed to find that racism was so gnarly that I did not feel at home, even in the spaces that said queerness was, you know, that queerness was fine, like lesbianness was fine, like homosexuality was fine. So I landed here and, you know, I found myself in the gay spaces at the time, LGBTQIA spaces, and didn't feel as if my Blackness mattered in that space. And so that sent me reeling into the kind of misfit, yawping, you know, complaining, raging spaces, which were poetry spaces on the Lower East Side, you know, even in Brooklyn in some places. It's an, like, my, you know, I'm struggling to find the words that will encompass the thoughts that are kind of swirling around in my head. So we were in this place. I entered the US thinking that there was this freedom of, like, you know, I don't know, maybe I'd read too many James Baldwin books. Maybe I had read, you know, Audre Lorde's, you know, work and imagined something different. And when I came here, like, race was such a huge problem. And I tumbled into the performance spaces where those conversations were happening. And so I spent a really long time working really hard in a world that, you know, everyone was trying to make the world better. So we were activists and we believed that if we worked hard, that we would chip away at the kind of white oppressive, you know, supremacist structures that existed. And I believed I would spend the rest of my life doing so. And so there was a way that I understood it. And we also were at you know, the LGBT community was just making space for voices of color, particularly some Black voices in the late 90s. I was a part of that. And so we were making strides. You know, we were getting, you know, people to recognize that queerness. We had just come off of, America had just come off of the fight for the right to live when you have the HIV virus and you have AIDS. So I came into a time when it was fraught with activism and struggle, and I enjoyed it and loved it and wept and raged and was fully alive in that time. And then in 2012, I had a baby and I kind of became kind of like a mom, and I had a very cute baby, and, you know, I was kind of reaping the fruits of that struggle of decades that were behind me. And I was raising this kid and I was teaching her how to be fierce, I thought. I was teaching her, I mean, Hillary, not the candidate that I would create if I were the artist, but we were here with her and we were going to break this glass ceiling, and we had just had Obama in, and things were just looking as if they weren't perfect. You know, Obama dropped a lot of drones and Hillary was poised to do the same. And Hillary had some problems around race in the way that her history and her staff were, you know, had dealt with race historically. And then came this president, and I think he has done so much to deconstruct our idea of where we were with progress. I think myself, along with a lot of other people that I know, they are quite shell-shocked with where we are now. That I people are disappointed and bitter, and they never thought that they would be here. They thought we had passed the space where a president would send federal agents to in unmarked cars to pick up citizens in protest. We were away from the time when a president would say something about, like, Mexicans being, you know, murderers and rapists. We were away from a time where a man could get elected when he said that he would grab women by their vaginas and that without their permission, and that they wouldn't do anything because when you're a star, they let you do it. You know, I really thought that even at the highest levels, that even if those things were happening, that there would be attempts made to make sure that it wasn't so overt. I knew that those things happened, but I didn't know that we were at a place where, you know, all the president's drawers would be hanging out like that and everybody would still kind of vote for him. We are in the most perfect representation of the emperor has no clothes. And I don't know why the rest of the country isn't listening to us screaming, he's naked, he's naked, he's naked.
Hmm. Okay.
I have the perfect poem to slip right into that space, shall we?
Let's slip it in.
It's a very long answer to a very short question, but it's that tangle of emotion. You never quite know, you know, this one's called Not My President. Every time I step to a microphone, I develop the uncontrollable urge to shout, Donald J. Trump is not my president. And that's not just because I didn't vote for the fool. Not just because he's become the latest tool members of the contemporary clan pull out from their modern day sheets to remind us of when their cloths covered this land with the brutal hand of white racist terror. If you've ever had to dress down some melon challenge motherfucker talking about all lives matter, raise your right hand and say amen. So you know exactly what I mean when I say Donald J. Trump cannot be recognized as no motherfucking president. First of all, he's been breathing on this planet for 70 years and still has the vocabulary of a third grader. Not to mention his mouth always looks to me like an incontinent asshole that can't hold its own bullshit in, spewing the septic defecation of ignorance and discrimination, contaminating the already polluted air with inarticulate entitlement, steady providing validation for all them other white men who feel like equal opportunity for anyone else means we are trying to motherfucking oppress them. Donald J. Trump could never be my president because he began his political career by questioning the legitimacy of the very first Black president elected in a country built upon the hardworking backs of African Americans. He could never be my president because he had the gall to call for Barack Obama's birth papers as if this were 1831 and he was one of them cruel white men, free to grab any black body and demand documents. In the America we say we are fighting to create, men like that can no more lead us than can a predominantly white police force protect the black descendants of the very brown bodies they enslaved to gain a racial advantage they refuse to let go of, no matter how obvious it is that in America, race and opportunity are linked, like poverty and the prison system, like rape and a woman's right to choose, like who has wealth and who pays the least taxes, like gerrymandering and who gets the right to vote. It's time for poor white folks to admit they've all been sold a 6 for a fucking 9. This con artistry of race and sex and economy isn't new. Donald J. Trump is just another white knot in the noose they keep tying around the necks of the disadvantaged majority. Just another fairy tale in the elaborate inheritance of lies they sell to anyone who isn't rich or white or longing for the good old days when racially cloaked narratives of nationality were the only histories available to average Americans, fed to them to keep them from being woke, to keep them from poking too deeply into whose pockets most of the wealth that ordinary people work for from 9 to 5 every day in this country goes. Black people have had enough of this systematic bullshit. Between the 500 years of unrelenting racism and the recent rise of this fake-ass, over-tanned, idiotic orangutan, black bodies have got no more tears left to cry. We ready to try some next-level shit, to resurrect some Black Panther, Angela Davis, Asata Shakur shit. I'm willing to bet the same is true for the rest of y'all motherfuckers. Having spent my whole life fighting for better than this, I refuse to give deference to this walking, shameful evidence of what fear and prejudice and a little Russian interference can birth in a nation obviously asleep at the wheel of our own democratic elections. Donald J. Trump is not my president because his tenure in the White House is a result of unchecked sexism, a culture of rape, and the ever-present undercurrents of a newly emerging 21st century Ku Klux Klan. Donald J. Trump is not my president because he wants to disappear my Muslim neighbors, because he wants to deport Mexican-American families, because he fails to recognize that the only Americans who are not immigrant Americans are Native Americans. He is not my president because he sexualizes his own daughter. He will never be my president because I want to clearly demonstrate to my daughter that a man who boasts about grabbing women by their vaginas without their permission does not ever deserve her respect, no matter who he is or how rich he says he is. That even though that egotistical airhead masterminded and pulled off the greatest political coup in the history of modern elections, he remains nothing but an illegitimate, embarrassing burden I hope we don't have to carry for another 4 years. Every time I see this orange snake slithering around on my screen, I want to break the fucking TV, rip it off the wall, and let it fall from my fifth floor apartment. I wish I could just close my eyes and pretend none of this is happening. But if we do not keep our eyes wide open, the consequences would be catastrophic. Every kind of resistance is necessary. When the arm of injustice persists, we have to develop new ways to resist. We cannot be discouraged by these political tricks of distraction. It will take longer than we anticipated to get this fucker off our TVs, out of office, and outside our collective consciousness. No matter how normalized these actions of this incredibly imbecilic and inhumane administration, no matter how numb we become to what the news anchors say every night, you have to say something different to yourself. Every day you have to say, Donald J. Trump is not my president, has never been my president, will never be my president. You have to make that shit mantra. You have to say it to your friend and your enemies. You have to say it to your fish, your parrot. You have to say it to everyone you meet. You have to say it over and over and over again every day. And one day, when everyone else sees he is no more than a snake oil salesman, no more than a Cheeto-dusted Freddy Krueger invading every aspect of our lives. Like all the walls of great divisiveness built before him, he will fall, revealing the yellow bellies of all those who brought him to power. And whoever was responsible, whoever is responsible, be it Vladimir or one of them funny looking Trump children, whoever it is, that Iago motherfucker will have to answer to the rest of humanity for this small handed wrinkle in this bumbleclot warp in time.
That kind of is the answer to how are you, isn't it?
I suppose.
Okay, we're going to take a break because we have to pay the bills. Capitalism at work. We have to keep the lights on, so I have to try to sell you some things. We'll be right back with Stacey Ann Chin. Sleep. We all love it, and most of us probably want more of it. But rather than getting a solid night's rest, we often find ourselves scrolling social media or reading the news when we should be powering down for the night. How many of you are guilty of that? I know I am. And it seems like lots of people in my social media feeds are struggling with insomnia. I've been using Calm, the app designed to help you ease stress and get the best sleep of your life. When I wake up after a good night's sleep, I feel like I can take on the world. Calm has a whole library of programs designed for healthy sleep, like soundscapes, guided meditations, and over 100 sleep stories, narrated by voices like Stephen Fry, Kelly Rowland, Laura Dern, even Harry Styles. Over 85 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds and get better sleep. For listeners of this show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's hundreds of hours of programming, Calm's entire library, and new content added every week. Get started today at calm.com/Tristan for 40% off a premium subscription. That's calm.com, calm.com/Tristan. I want you to have better sleep. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with Stacey Ann Chin, and we're talking about her collection of poetry, Crossfire, A Litany for Survival. So in this book, you cover a lot of terrain. Childhood abuse, misogynoir, sexual violence, racism, capitalism, poverty, inequity, plus a lot of queer sex. And that's kind of like just the first five pages. So I'm glad you read that poem because it like gives people a sense of the tenor of the book. But I'm wondering how the process is for you to write from a place of what at least comes across to this reader as very intense emotion.
And we all experience very intense emotions. I mean, and when you're talking about sex or rage or, you know, I think people just live with really intense emotions. I think society at large has indoctrinated us, encouraged us, mandated of us that we be quiet about these things. Like you can't just go to work one day and sit in your cubicle and then the other person's like, hey, how are you? And you're like, well, you know, I had sex with my partner last night and we worked really hard and I still didn't orgasm. You can't say that at work.
Mm-hmm.
But why wouldn't you be able to say, like, I mean, if, I don't know, if your mother-in-law came over and she was like a real difficult guest and, you know, she ended up like breaking your grandmother's favorite, I don't know, tea set, or I don't know. Do people have tea sets? I don't even know.
I don't know. But some people do, I guess. Yes.
Right. And so, you know, and then say, how are you? And you'd be like, oh my God, I had a really rough time last night. People would say that because that's an acceptable topic. So it's not that you're not allowed to talk about your feelings at all. It's just that intensity isn't. And so if you can say like, oh my God, my mother-in-law, and then somebody else is like, oh yeah, that's so crazy. But if women were to go into work and be like, I didn't orgasm last night and we tried so hard. And if other women were being honest, a lot of them would be like, yeah, that happened to me too, like twice this week. Because it's not the commonality of the topic. It's, and if you look at like, you know, white supremacy and like freedom and women's bodies, you know, I think AOC yesterday made a big talk about how misogyny and sexism and chauvinism is a part of a larger construct. It's like a police, it's a male dominated ideology of police, of policing of women's bodies. So the way that we've been talking about like the Black Lives Matter and how the police has been kind of, you know, having its knee on the neck of Black survival and Black existence, it's pretty much the same way that masculinity and its constructs, you know, has oppressed anything that has to do with women's freedom or women's pleasure or women's. There's a codification of it so deeply ingrained that people get upset if you cross the lines when you dress a little girl in like clothing that's supposed to be for boys or vice versa. Like people are so opted in, and they're such a strong believer. I mean, people are such strong believers in that system of sexual codification that everything is an outgrowth of that. We just don't talk about it. Just like for 500 years in this country, we haven't talked about race except for when we're raging about it. And then people are like, why are you getting so crazy? And it's the same thing, you know, like, you know, the woman who's a feminist, she becomes dangerous and crazy and hysterical.
And a bitch, right.
Right, you know, all of those words, I mean, that are, I'm talking about like in the ways that normal people talk about it. And I suppose people call women bitches all the time. I'm just kind of really not in that circle. Although I just moved in a neighborhood where that's, you know, I just bought a house in a neighborhood where that's a reality. I hear that word quite often now.
So
I write about it because I say, fuck you. I got my feelings, and like, you know, if I touch my vagina, I have feelings. And if I don't touch my vagina, I have feelings. And so I'm going to like share them with you. And I've been lucky enough. As I said, I landed into America, into an America that allowed me voice immediately, because it was Misfits. And, you know, you are one of those people in the middle of those like dark, dank bars in the late night. So you know that we welcomed, you know, the unsayable in those spaces. I'm sure you remember how it was to be yourself there. And that's why you would be there in this dirty bar late at night on a night when you probably had work the next day or some shit.
The day job. Okay. So you said unsayable. And I think that's something that is a theme throughout this book, which is that you speak the unspeakable.
Yes.
And there's also a lot about sexual violation and yes. about the control of women's bodies and women reclaiming their bodies.
Yes, yes. It is my hope that people will buy this book, read it, and then feminism wouldn't be necessary anymore, because we would have all like shifted just by reading this book. We would have shifted into a new era of like, you know, feminist utopia. That's my hope. Feminist, like, you know, I don't believe it will happen, but hope springs eternal in the breast of this, you know, earnest feminist.
So you also kind of refuse to be palatable to white people, to straight people, to gay people, to the establishment in any way. I'm remembering this poem. At the beginning, it said it was delivered at the Gay Games in 2006 in Chicago. Yeah. Yeah. And I actually worked for the Gay Games in New York City in 1994. It's it's very mainstream. It's very white. It's all about sort of this concept of unity and coming together, and sports as like this metaphor. And this poem you wrote was scathing. Angry and amazing. I mean, I'm wondering if like
there were 70,000 mostly gay white men, mostly middle upper class gay white men who could take time off to come be in the Gay Games, because you could just be in the Gay Games. I think at that time you could just show up, and you, as long as you could afford your entry fee, and you could turn up to all of the qualifying games. I mean, like, most people just were a part of it because they could afford it. And I was invited to speak, and I remember them asking me to give the poem to them ahead of time. And I knew that it was going to be a difficult sell ahead of time. So I didn't give them the poem at all. I just said, it's not ready yet. I'm still working on it. And if anyone knows like me at all, I'm probably working on it right up until I get to stage. I've got my pen and I'm scribbling and I'm crossing words out. I mean, even now in this book, I have to look for my reading copy because I've made changes in these poems. And so when we did the rehearsals were maybe 2 or so hours before performance time. And I delivered it to the staff, mostly staff, like mm-hmm. a lot, people of color, not necessarily wealthy people. And the staff was just very appreciative and encouraging. And I was like, okay, good, we're going to be okay. And then I delivered it that night to the 70,000 people in, I think it's a Soldier's Field arena. And I would say at least a quarter of that audience was pissed because I was shitting on their parade. Oh my God, we're such great people and we're activists because we are running around in the shortest shorts and tittering as much as we can. And it's such a great space. And I think there is room for the kind of recreation of the teenagehood you never had when you are queer and you're unable to be out. Definitely. But I think that cannot be the overarching theme whenever we say we are talking about an LGBT community, because the LGBT community is not largely rich and white and male and longing for a teenhood that they never had. I think you have LGBT moms and LGBT, siblings and people who are struggling to get their jobs to pay them minimum wage and to not have their bosses sexually harass them. I mean, I think the community of the LGBTQIA community is far more diverse than the LGBT agenda has ever made it, has mm-hmm. ever like made space for. You know, like we haven't, it's just like all the time, the disabled community in the LGBT community, it's always like an aside sort of. It's always like these kind of like heteronormative versions of ourselves that are like presented. And so in the early edition of the LGBTQIA images, there were these white couples who pretty much looked like the Cleavers, but they were like maybe two men or two women and usually white. And then they kind of upgraded that to include some people of color, but the people who we think are like beautiful and are in like the physical condition that we most value. I mean, the diversity in the community, I mean, all my life I've used my space as a meeting place for the LGBTQIA community. And so people come to my house and I look around the room and it's always more diverse than anywhere I see posters from anybody. Mm-hmm. And that bothers me because it means that we are consistently, you know, ignoring, oppressing, marginalizing, invisibilizing, disappearing people in pretty much the way we're now disappearing immigrants. You know, there are undocumented LGBTQIA people or documented LGBTQIA people with undocumented relatives. I mean, the ways in which we are connected are so wildly diverse. Every time we talk about the LGBTQIA community, we have to make space for the people who do not look like, sound like, behave like these people who we see on TV. Not everybody is Ellen.
Well, and also it's like a misrepresentation of the community.
For sure.
It's a sort of a fabrication of mm-hmm. this is who we are and this is what we look like. And that always has excluded very genderqueer people, gender nonconforming folks, drag queens, mm-hmm. leather daddies, butches, all those folks have never been part of the sort of gay with a capital G kind of, agenda or politic.
And I feel like we are consistently working to include whatever group is, you know, the community is crying out to say, oh, you've not been including this community. And I don't think our emphasis should be on like, oh, we've been leaving out Black, you know, Black people, so let's include Black people. Oh, we've been leaving out Native Americans, let's include Native Americans. What it should be is that we should endeavor to create, construct a system that is ever evolving, where the door is wide open and easy to swing for the groups that we are consistently not even aware of to move into the space. So the construct is wrong. This gatekeeping that white men have set up, it trickles down in the feminist movement. It trickles down in the LGBTQIA movement. It trickles down in the Black Power movement. It trickles down in so many different places where essentially people are looking out for people who look like them, who they value, and are looking to close the space so that these people remain the most valuable in a construct they are building. The construct has to change. You know, you hear people say, you know, like, don't bring people to the table. Move the table. Break up the fucking table. Make it a circle. Make it a moving conversation where people can move to one side of the room and have conversations. And I don't know. I mean, like, the metaphors could go crazy here. I mean, you know, you and I are word lovers, so we could go crazy here. But essentially, how we've been doing it, we've been fucking up. We've been fucking up, like, for real. Because every time you look around, a new group has been excluded, marginalized, disappeared, exploited, taken advantage of, used in order to make it look as if we are becoming more inclusive. So something is wrong with our methodology. Something is wrong with the way we're doing it.
Well, I think it just reinforces the existing power structure, right? That... and that's the complaint of lots of marginalized folks, even within queer communities, is like, you put us on your posters and you have one of us on a panel, but there are no marginalized voices in power. There are no marginalized voices in the room where the decisions are being made, where the money is being given out or allocated. And so it still feels like a top-down approach.
Exactly. And I mean, I'm almost 50. And, you know, I would say, I would venture to say, deign to say, dare to say that I've had a successful career in the field in which I've been working for 20 years. And I had to like, take up a collection plate in order to like, buy a home. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, there aren't 100,000, a million, 20 million, tens of millions of people who are not in the same position I am, but they're not like successful in their careers. So when you line it up, it's always important to make sure that when you're talking about your own story of oppression, that you acknowledge that there's privilege in it as well. Because that's how we change the structure, because you can't talk about your own oppression and pretend as if you don't have privilege. So I say that the fact that I'm able to acquire a home for me and my daughter is in itself a miracle and a privilege in the country in which we live, in the time in which we exist, in the economic space in which we are now surviving. I understand that. Set that aside, and all the people with whom I am consistently on panels, in performance spaces, I am paired up with in terms of like, you know, my contemporaries, my white contemporaries, none of them are begging money to buy homes. All of them own a home and they own a second home, or they definitely don't own a home in a neighborhood where they have to worry about the safety of their kid, which is where I am. I mean, and I'm not complaining. I'm only saying that it is clear that my white counterparts earn far more than I do and struggle far less financially, even though we're in the same level of success.
Yeah. I want to give you an opportunity to do another poem before we take a break.
And because we have to have, you know, nails down my back don't scare me. Even when they leave trails in threes and fours, running down the length of my spine, making my roommate wonder, what are they doing in that bathroom so long? I don't mind the soft touch of knuckles grazing cheeks, fingertips touching breast tips so gently the orgasm is afraid to come. One out of every five times, I prefer that slow, easy kind of loving that makes the body slide into itself, sleepy and complete with the cat-like purring of a puss well-stroked. But on the ordinary day, when I've written a good poem or a fucked up poem, a poem I'm too ashamed to let the other poet see, I want a leash with my name on it, attached to a collar with tiny silver studs to press into me when I attempt to escape. I want to wear cheap lingerie so you can rip the lace into strips you'll use to tie my hands together and spank me for exposing the details of our not-so-ordinary sex life. And I think it's good to be 110 pounds. That way, you can get into my hard-to-reach places easily. And I seriously doubt you could do that. Twist a thing with a woman much bigger than this. That thing where I'm standing on the side of the bath and I'm not allowed to hold on to the curtain rod and you behind making me, or that other thing where I'm in the kitchen and you hoist me up onto the counter by my knees and dinner is a little bit later than we planned. Those days I don't want quiet. I wouldn't know what to do with it. I like it when there are screams and battle scars and trophies. That way, before the war begins, I already know what I'm about to fight for.
That's from the book Crossfire by Stacey Ann Chin. We're going to take another break. And when we come back, let's talk about sex and love and relationships. So stay with us. Hi, all. It's pretty difficult to talk about things other than what's going on in our world right now. So delivering these ads to you are tricky for me, and I want to be transparent and honest about that. But also, these advertisers make it possible for us to do the show. And I believe in the ability of this show to help people. I don't consider pleasure something extra or frivolous or unnecessary right now. It is absolutely a part of resistance, justice, and freedom. One of our advertisers is Uber Lube. They make a great body-safe silicone lube with only two ingredients, silicone and vitamin E. No additives like parabens, preservatives, or petrochemicals. It's great for all kinds of sex play. Uber Lube adds a thin layer that leads to just the right amount of slip while still allowing for skin-on-skin sensations. If you need some lube, they're offering Sex Out Loud listeners a special offer. 10% off and free shipping when you use my code Tristan at uberlube.com. That's 10% off and free shipping. Just use the code Tristan at uberlube.com. Uber Lube lets you feel what you want to feel. You may have noticed the flowers are blooming, the grass is growing, and it's time to mow your lawn. Thanks to our sponsor, Manscaped, you can trim the hedges below the belt safely and efficiently. You know I don't like to beat around the bush, so I won't. Everyone could use a little trim of their pubic hair. Manscaped, the only men's brand dedicated to below-the-waist grooming, is here to make sure your balls, people with balls, are smooth and smelling nice. After all, it's time for some spring and, let's face it, summer cleaning. I actually like to do grooming with a partner. I find it really sexy, but I've used razors before and I'm always afraid to nick their genitals. Scary. You have to use the right tools for the job. When I use the Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0, I know it's safe and it always does a great job. The Perfect Package 3.0 kit comes with the lawnmower, the waterproof cordless body trimmer, anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer, and the crop reviver to round out your manscaping routine. This third generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce manscaping accidents. Millions of balls are about to be nick-free thanks to Manscaped advanced skin-safe technology. Subscribe to the Perfect Package and get a new replacement blade refill for your lawnmower trimmer delivered to your door every 3 months. For a limited time, subscribers get two free gifts: the Shed Travel Bag, a $39 value, and the patented high-performance reduced chafing Manscaped Boxer Briefs. You should really try this out, and I've got a deal for you to get started. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code Tristan at manscaped.com. That's right. Go to manscaped.com and get 20% off with free shipping when you use the code Tristan. Your balls will thank you. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with force to be reckoned with, Stacey Ann Chin. who has a great collection. It's a compilation of the first really curated collection of all of, or most of, or a lot of her poetry. It's called Crossfire. And so I think, okay, so for me, your poems about relationships and love feel different from your other subject matter. They're like a little more murky and messy and complicated. And as a reader, they're harder to pin down. And I wonder what you think of that reading of it.
I think so. I mean, like in real life, it's pretty much the same. Like, I figured out like a lot of things in life. I just haven't figured out the whole women, love, sex, drive, you know, all in one pot kind of thing. You know, I think I can do sex, like in a vacuum, you know, like sex is easy. Like, you know, I can, from the minute we get to whatever surface we are going to be either leaning or lying or, climbing and rising upon, there's, you know, we get there and then to the end where the orgasm happens, I think I have that stuff on lock. but when you mix that into a relationship and you add your personal history and you add, you know, commitment and you add work and you add understanding and listening to each other and trying to respect each other, and like, then it just becomes like this soup where I'm like, I'm not sure where anybody's leg is. I can't find the clitoris. Like the shoulder seems a little bit jutting where it shouldn't be. Somebody's poking me in the eye with an elbow and it's not like intentional. Like it's just messy. And, you know, the joke in my circle of friends is that, you know, these women always leave me, but, I think consistently I've heard, but you leave us first. You know, I don't know. You know, I think that the way that we learn to love and the messages we get about sex are so coded, latent, but are so insidious. They are like inside of us. They are tentacles and veins and tendons. I mean, it's not just skin that you can kind of slough away. They're deep in the bone of us, and they only start to rattle when they are shaken, you know, and then they rattle all of you, and they rattle your partner, and they rattle your kid. And, you know, I just haven't been able to figure it out, you know. So I'm on the hunt for the woman who will help me to figure this out. She has to be full of patience, and she has to be adventurous, and she has to be okay with my inability to deal with commitment. And she has to listen to me a lot, and she has to be okay when I don't want to listen to her. You know, so you see where the problems lie, though, Tristan.
Well, I see the sort of how this wouldn't make for like a Match.com profile.
No. This is like troubled lesbian in seek of person who will take a lot of shit and survive it and still make her feel good about herself. .com.
But it's so bracingly honest also.
I don't know if it's honest because it's not who I want to be. Like I'm attempting to be something else every day. And I mean, it's all tongue in cheek. I think I work very hard to be in relationships. And I think the partners I've had have worked very hard to be in relationship, in good relations with me. But I think we haven't, you know, I mean, if when you have a lot of like difficult things happen to you, you both have to practice so much patience, you know, like mm-hmm. She has to be okay when I don't want to listen to her, but I also have to be okay when she doesn't want to listen to me. And there's this like notion of love that we've constructed around this kind of like, isn't it romantic film? Where, you know, your partner is supposed to be everything you need when you need it. And they'll always forgive you and they're supposed to forgive you. There's a kind of entitled assumption that they'll forgive you when you're like falling fucking short of just being like a decent human being. And then there's like denial in it too, when you're called upon it. I mean, it's so messy. Like the first 6 to 8 months in a relationship, maybe even the first year, is so good. When everybody's trying, And then it's like everybody just gives up the ghost run about the end of the first year. and then it just all falls to shit. But I must say that I have friends who have had like successful relationships and are good at compromise. I think that I was left when I was very young. And so I've been steering my own boat since I was about 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how to share the steering now. I'm not so good at sharing. And worse now that I have a kid that I feel like I have to like stand up for and make a relationship kind of make a hard, I don't know. As you can see, my answers in this period of the sex and the love and the relationship shit are like remarkably ineloquent. Can we go back to talking about revolution where I'm so much more poetic and it's so much sexier? Don't you think, Tristan, should we not just erase this part and pretend that I am more together than I am? You don't think that's like a position that we could take in this fucking show here?
Well... No, I don't know if we should erase it.
I hear you struggling to say no. Are you a millennial?
No, I'm your age. I'm about to be 50.
Yeah, I mean, you're struggling with that kind of like, I can't say no. You'd be like, fuck you. This is the stuff of which like honesty is made. It's a good show.
Yeah, it's a good show.
We're not here to make you look good, Stacey. And we're here to talk about this shit.
And make you look good. Okay, we'll go back to the revolution.
But sex is a kind of revolution, right?
Yes. Well, I love the idea that you used sex as this kind of metaphor for when it's sex, I've got it handled. But then when it's a relationship or love or just relating and being in just relationship, it's like you're flying blind.
Do you know the answers? Can you give them to me so that I can be better when I'm finished with this segment? Is there any way that you could kind of like just get, you know, are you partnered?
I have several lovers in my life, but I'm not in a committed, like primary partnership.
Okay. You're like Jada. You have entanglements.
they all know about each other. I was in a 15-year like marriage with a queer person. And I got divorced. And so I'm a little gun shy.
I hear you, but that's really wonderful that someone stayed for 15 years and you stayed for 15 years. Like to date, my longest relationship has been 5 years. And we had, I think like three like big breaks in like 1 8 months, 7 months or 6 months, a couple of like 3 or 4 months breaks in between. Like, and before that it was 3.5, like, yeah, I mean, 15 years is an accomplishment. Even that, when you say you're a little gun shy, why would you be gun shy? You had like 15 years with a human and you learned so much about yourself and about that person and pushed yourself beyond, you know, how we usually know someone else. That's a success story.
Yeah. I mean, I know that on some intellectual level, but on an emotional level, it feels like ending is a failure.
That's what I'm saying. But isn't it wild though? Because we all feel that way. But when I look back at the many relationships I've had in the last 23 years, I see so much beauty and love and joy and sex and beautiful, like amazing experiences. And each person came in and brought me to a place that was new and beautiful and interesting. And I grew and, you know, never has there been a repeat of anything that happened. Like each one had its own joy. But I still feel as if when I'm assessing them together, I assess them primarily as if they are an accumulative, you know, failure. Even though, like, I mean, I never would have, if the first one had worked, I never would have met the others. And it would have been an unknown regret, but it would have been like thinking now that I would never have loved all the women I've loved. It would have been sad for me to know that I would have missed out on those things.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, and the construct in which we live, You can't have all of those things and have any one of them work except the last one.
Well, and also I think that no matter how much we've tried to like I'm certainly have tried to unlearn and deprogram so much about the construct of love and relationships. It's pretty baked into US society, how it should be. And I've had a lot of relationships that don't look like how it should be.
Yes, yes. The closer I get to someone, the more they know me and the more I know them, sort of. But like, it's really more about how, the more they know about me, the less I'm able to function with them, because the more paranoid I begin to feel like they won't love me eventually. When they really know all of the terrible things I am, they won't love me. And so it becomes like self-fulfilling prophecy in that I'm just waiting for them to leave, because I know that they're going to discover all of these complicated, difficult truths about me, and they're going to leave me, and they're going to not be attracted to me and not love me. And I don't want that to sneak up on me unawares. And one of the ways I begin to manifest that is to pull away sexually.
Well, and I think that totally resonates with me, because I think that's where like the fear piece is will you like see all of me and still be able to hold me? Because sometimes I see all of me and I can't hold it.
Mm-hmm. And then it brings us to this other conversation, is why should you always be able to hold me? Sometimes you'll be able to hold me, and then sometimes somebody else holds me, not necessarily sexually, that's not your thing, but you have all these friends and all these cousins and all these, you know, people with whom you have like deep, intimate connections of friendship and, you know, workship and scholarship and, you know, activism-ship. And those people will hold you at different points, and I don't need to hold you all the time.
You're right. And I think we do need to expand the idea of intimacy, because I feel like I've had intense intimacy with friends who are platonic, and also intense intimacy in working relationship, on like a project with someone. It can be like really fulfilling and can be really like a turn on to build something, to create something from nothing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree 100%. 100%. But, you know, I just like, you hear when we took the conversation just now to the intellectual realm, you see how we could make very, you know, kind of cogent, clear, eloquent sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we allow our feelings, yours and mine, to creep into it, when we allow the body to be present, when we allow the flesh to be informing, then I become ineloquent, and I start vibrating with an inability to follow a through line.
Mm. And I don't think of you as someone who subscribes to a through line.
Not really.
So you're a mom now. You talk about this in your book. You've talked about it. What is the future you want to see and help create for your daughter?
I just want a better world, a freer world. I want a world that she won't be so brutally confined, contained. And so everything has to change in order to get that for her. And because I know that I live in a tradition of people who try to change the world and have tried for centuries to change the world, I imagine that it will take more than my daughter's lifetime to get it to the place where I imagine it should be. And so I hope to gift her the resilience, the tools, the desire, the kind of community that she would need to participate in this struggle for her whole life, and to have people who affirm her as she struggles And as she triumphs, you know, I'm beginning to have less and less specific dreams for her because I am watching her come into her own dream for herself.
Mm. How old is she?
She's 8.
Oh.
And so I look at her now.
That's a really good line, by the way, for a poem. I have less specific dreams because I'm watching her come into her own dreams.
Yes. So now I'm, you know, when she was born, I was very much a looming kind of like over hovering, shadowing figure, you know, in terms of like my body was a looming buffer between her and the world that could hurt her. Mm-hmm. And now I find myself playing support, you know. I'm less the, you know, the person who plays center, the quarterback. You know, I'm less that person. I'm more the person who, you know, kind of hovers in her general space. And, you know, I'm the caddy, not the golfer.
So weird of you to make a golf reference. It's probably the most unexpected thing you've done today. Okay, I have to stop talking to you at some point, which I don't want to, but I want to.
But I get it. I get it.
I want to close with what brings you pleasure right now?
Hacking away at the overgrown backyard that I have in this house that I bought in a little neighborhood called Weeksville. Weeksville was created, I think, 200 years ago by, you know, enslaved Africans who had come north and wanted to participate in the voting system. And the only way they could vote in New York was to buy land. And so they all bought this, James Weeksville, bought this patch of land and divided up with these, these free Africans who used to be enslaved in the South, and they could now vote just because they had a land. And then this community has been there for a long time, and it's kind of died away and then kind of resurfaced again. And my home is in that community, and I look forward to making it beautiful and creating a space for my own child to dream and have her own friends come over and dream. And I'm looking forward to all of the post-COVID parties with all the women and all of the non-gender conforming and all of the queer folk and all of the straight allies who will come and drink wine in the backyard and dance and sit upon the kitchen counter and talk politics. So I'm making that home now. And it gives me so much pleasure to imagine how we will take up space in it and make noise in it and laugh and dance with each other and flirt and talk politics and create whatever new world will emerge after this pandemic.
Do you want to leave us with another poem? Do you have time? Do you want to go?
I could read a short one, yes.
Okay.
In response to Danish, the 6-year-old Pakistani passenger who asked me why I write. For myself, I tell her, for fear there might be nothing left beyond this ritual, this excess of religion, the reason mankind loves condemnation and images of a white male god. For Jamaica, the island that rejected me once, for my fingers writing impossible sonnets on the inner muscle of a female thigh. For the women I left there, bleeding for the zygote of that lust aborted for just being. They still live there, far from the hands that pushed me down the staircase with broken banister, because we all need to push back at something sometimes. For the skeletons I write only in inked outlines, for the vibrator that crosses state lines with me, for the nights I sleep alone, for the man I left because he could not understand when I complained of cramping heavily 1 month, for my father, who has only ever wrapped his lips around my name once, for my grandmother, who hums it every morning in prayer, for the fear of my mother, who might very well be mad, for the way I move my hands like her when I speak, for the words that threaten insanity if I do not speak out loud, for the child I hope to nurture from my navel one day, for the world I will be afraid to pass on to her, for this version of America for the drunks who rest their conscience in open gutters before dawn, for denouncing Hitler, for South America, for history and Ayatollah, for the women who never loved me, for the ones who always loved me back, for Angela and Annalisa, for Asha and Andrea, for Alexandra, for Ariana, who writes happy poems because she believes in dancing, for this alphabet of needs we swallow without fluid every day, for Alejandra, who lives in Austria, for Brent, who went back to Trinidad, for the letter C, because I cannot say her name for fear of her safety, for Deanne, for Alicia, for Fernando, and for Peter. And to move this alphabet poem along, I write for Quraysh and his sons, for Raquel, who loved me when I chose not to love her back, for lost strangers speaking in musical foreign tongues, for the violence we ignore as long as it is not being done to us, for the violence we ignore as long as it is not being done to us, for undoing those secrets our mothers told us never to speak of, for Malcolm, who wrote his name the only way he could not spell slave, for Lorraine Hansberry, who always wrote like she was black, for the young and the gifted, for the lack of causes that still reflect us, for the surrender we refuse to write, for the dream, for the dried grapes of wrath, for the reasons so many shadows continue to exist, because the world will not accept the people who live in fear behind them.
The book is called Crossfire, A Litany for Survival. It's published by Haymarket Books and available wherever you get books, but I especially encourage people to support local and independent bookstores, which you can do through bookshop.org. Stacey Ann Chin, thanks so much for being
here. Biggest love.
What?
I said biggest love, and thank you for having me. That was such a great chat.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the work you put in the world and for everything you are.
Well, thank you for doing this show, and I can't wait to hear it, Jesus Christ.
Yay! Okay, we've got to go on about our days.
All right. So, you know, reach out from time to time and tell me how you are doing in this LAite world, in this LA.
You got to come here. You know, we just got them to stop building the biggest prison expansion in the city. Like, we're doing stuff.
Californians be not fucking around. I understand. I understand. All righty. Well,
okay.
And we'll talk soon.
Okay. Bye. Right,
super. Thank you, Tristan.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye.
You can find Stacey Ann Chin online at stacyannchin.net. She's also at Stacey Ann Chin on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can see performances of her work on YouTube. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, my amazing advertisers, and of course, my engineer and editor, A-Rod, Aaron Rodriguez. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Monday. And until then, you can catch me on social media. I'm at Tristan Taramino across all platforms. The show is at Sex Out Loud Radio on Twitter. And I hope this book has inspired you in the way that it's inspired me. Till next time.